get hit me, keep a glass of water, please. Richard? No, Richard, put your glass of water, please. Cold water. It's getting me dry. ब्रह्मानंदं परमसुखदं केवलं ज्ञानमूर्तिं द्वन्द्वातीतं गगनसदृशं तत्त्वमस्यादिलक्ष्यं एकं नित्यं विमलमचलं सर्वधी साक्षिभूतं भावातीतं त्रिगुणरहितं सद्गुरुं तन्नमामि अज्ञानतिमिरान्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति 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 It was a sort of tradition. Whether one likes these traditions or not, that before we commence any serious quest, we should bow to the Guru as with everything. Corruption sets in once a tradition is carried on without regard to the spirit. There is nothing wrong with the tradition. Come over here. I won't be able to reach that far. Come on. There is probably nothing wrong with the tradition. Because even when we discard one tradition, we shall soon be creating our own tradition. She doesn't like to wear her grandmother's clothes. Okay, she's starting a new tradition now. In a few years' time, this will be the fashion. When she becomes a grandmother, this will be the tradition. And then her granddaughter is going to break off from this tradition and get back to what her grandmother wore. It's just a matter of a rebellion which, for the sake of rebellion, I may throw a tradition away, but can I prevent another tradition being brought into being? I may not want to regard anyone as my guru. That's perfectly all right. I don't have to. But in discarding my guru, I am making somebody else as my guru. I wonder if that is clear. He has someone as his guru. She has someone as his guru, as her guru. I come along and tell them, look, don't drop all this guru business. And both of them say, yes, Swami, we will not have any devotion to our guru. In that, what have they doing now? What have they done now? They have taken me as their guru. No doubt, both are subject to corruption. To have a guru and to be blindly devoted to him, forgetting his teaching, forgetting that the best way to
pay our homage to the Guru is to keep his light burning within us. Blindly hero worshipping the Guru is a corruption. In the same way, blindly rejecting the Guru is another type of corruption which promotes my own egoism. I don't want to bow down to anybody. I don't want to enter into political discussions here. But that is what happened in some countries of the world. I know of. I can give you the example of India. Somebody, some great political leader, a sort of idol of all the young people, he stood up and says, "Nonsense, you shouldn't bow your head down to anybody." When someone, a villager, came to bow down to him, he said, "Nonsense, that's slave mentality. You shouldn't bow down to anybody. You are also a man, I am also a man. Why should you bow down to me?" Wonderful, that's right. Sensible. Probably, the man who came to bow down to this gentleman bowed down to him mentally in any case, because his admiration went up, higher up. If I allowed this young man to bow down to me, devotion naturally manifests in him. If I tell him, no, you and I are one, I don't want you to bow down to me, he is going to go away with greater veneration. Ah, this Swami is so great that he doesn't even accept my prostrations. That's probably what happened to him. But then, when this news went round that so-and-so said that bowing down, one human being bowing down to another is a manifestation of slave mentality, all the young people got the imagination of everybody. So, the next thing that the people knew was that the college students were telling off their professors, "You are also a man, I am also a man, why should you sit up there? I can also sit to higher up, I am a younger man. You may be a professor, I may be a student, what right have you to examine me?" Right? What was the result? Riot, chaos. Who was responsible? The man who said that one human being should not bow down to another, respect another human being. Probably he didn't say so. Probably he only meant the slavishly bowing down to one another, touching one another's feet is unhealthy. So that if blindly we establish a counter tradition declaring that since all of us are created equal, one doesn't have, should not bow down to another, it seems to make sense, but it does not. What are we battling with in our life? What is my problem? What is my problem? I want to realize the truth, self-realization. Very good. What is my problem? I want to attain cosmic consciousness. What is my problem? I want to expand my mind so that it becomes cosmic consciousness. Very well, but what is the problem? What stops me from doing this? What stops me from doing this?
Love.
What stops me from doing this? What stands between me and that? Me. Me is the only thing that stands between me and that. If you want to use the word God, use it. If you want to use the word that, truth, anything, you use it. Christ or cosmic consciousness, Nirvana. What stands between me and that? The me only. The moment this me is gone, that alone remains. It is this false sense of ego, me, that is the problem. And therefore, a wise seeker, all seekers are not wise. All students of yoga are not wise. All human beings are not wise. And it was Dr. Einstein who said that by the very nature of things, the majority of human beings in the world will at all times be foolish. The masses. Therefore, a wise seeker, a wise man, who is aware, who is conscious of this problem, fundamental problem in life. There is conflict between you and me because me. If the moment the me is gone, there is no conflict. It is the me that creates all this conflict. It's I, the selfish ego, that creates all this conflict. So the wise man, the wise student of yoga, the seeker, will ensure at every step that this I doesn't come up and intrude. Anything that this I creates, he looks upon with suspicion. If the I creates a sophisticated society, the wise man looks upon that society with suspicion. If I am asked to acquire money and status, position, prestige, respectability, which means I am trying to bloat this ego, if I am wise, I look upon that with suspicion. At the same time, if I am told that I don't have to respect you because I am as good as you are, and if I am a wise student of yoga, I look upon that with suspicion, because there I see, I can sense that this doctrine may lead me or leave me with a fatter ego. You uncomfortable, sir? This doctrine may lead me with a fatter ego, more harder, stronger ego. I don't want it. So that one, in examining these traditions, somebody there asked them to come in, come in, come in, sir. Please come up here. No, don't block the road. Don't block the way. In examining these traditions, one has therefore to be extremely cautious and vigilant, that we don't blindly reject a tradition without examining it. What is this tradition of adoration of the guru. What is the thing called, what is the thing called guru? What does it mean? What does the word mean? One has to be very careful here. We are not creating a tradition. We are examining a fact. We are examining the truth. Without bias, one way or the other. What does this word guru mean? Gukarascha andhakarascha rukarastha nirodaka andhakara vinashitvat guriritya vidyate. This is the definition given in Sanskrit. It means the destroyer of the darkness of ignorance in one is the guru. The destroyer of the darkness of ignorance in one is the guru. Without the destruction of the darkness of ignorance, is it possible for me to see the truth? We are not talking at all about his being a guru or her being a guru or whatever it is. Is it possible for me to see the truth? Unless this darkness of ignorance within me is removed? No, obviously not. In order to see your face, I need this light. This light is my guru. This light is there, your face is still there, but I cannot see. What was necessary? My eyesight is necessary. So my own eyesight is my guru. My eyes may be there, this light may be there, your face may be there, but I may not be there. I may be dead. So there is this inner light which is my guru. Right? What is extremely important and essential here is to remember this fact that the guru is still there. Whether I can regard him as my guru or not, that is a debatable point. But guru is necessary. Without this light, I cannot see. Without this inner light, I cannot see. This light is there, her face is there, my eyes are there, the inner light is there. I still do not see her face. Why? I am looking elsewhere. Now what is essential? Someone to direct my attention to her face is also essential. With all this, I can still make a mess of my life. If there is no one to direct my attention to this inner light, to this truth, I may still make a mess of my life. Therefore, this tradition of guru is not that simple. People slip into one or the other of these extremes. Either people begin to hero worship and personal idolize a personality. He is my guru, and so I'll only accept his teachings and not your teachings, etc., etc., and then begin to fight and quarrel and all sorts of things. Or people jump to the other extreme of saying there is no guru, nonsense. All these gurus must be burnt. Can we not keep our eyes open? Can we not ensure that we do not blindly accept this tradition or blindly reject this tradition, but wisely examine the tradition, wisely examine our position. If we don't want the tradition, don't want it. Okay. But we wisely examine the position in which we find ourselves. And discover the way out. And in this discovery of the way out, I need these two things. The inner light and someone who directs my attention to this inner light. That person is outside, but the inner light is within. One is as important as the other. We can't say that the inner light will do. We can't say that the outer thing is terribly important or indispensable. Or I am getting my inspiration from this external agent. I don't know if you have ever thought about this. I'll give you one example and then we'll come back to your the example perhaps which is more appealing to you, which is more in your idiom. There is a shrine in India, in the Himalayas. It is a very difficult access. It is right in the Himalayas. You have to walk about 200 miles up and down hills and dales for days and days together in order to get there. It's very difficult to get there. And very often, people go there after traveling thousands of miles. They probably come from different parts of India or from overseas. Some come from Africa, some come from Australia, all sorts of places on earth. And they undertake this pilgrimage. The expense is great. The trouble is great. Very often people had to walk those 200, 400 miles up and down. There is a shrine there. In that shrine there is a small statue of Vishnu. The Hindus, Indians, very firmly believe that that statue represents God. To have a look at it is the culmination of their ambitions. That's why they come there. I went to this temple once and the temple was opened, all these devotees had filed into the shrine. The priest lit a piece of camphor and was about to wave this lighted camphor in front of the idol, in front of the statue. That is what makes the people see the statue. Immediately that is done, everyone without exception did this. I looked at them, why do you do this here? Why do you want to close your eyes and bow down? If just at the moment the statue is going to be illumined by the priest, you came to see this. You came to see the statue. You came to see the idol, thinking it is a symbol of God. And just when you are there, you close your eyes and bow down. What a funny thing. If you wanted to close your eyes, you could as well have remained at home. If you did not want to see the statue at all, if you are not particular about seeing the statue, why did you have to come here all the way? You could have gone to Switzerland. Lovely mountains are there. Snow-capped mountains are there. Beautiful forests may be there. You see the fun? And yet there is great meaning in it. They realize that the God they want, that they are trying to see, is within themselves. Subconsciously. But that they were not able to experience this presence in their own home. They needed an agent, an external agent. You know this too. When you hold in your hand your baby or someone whom you love intimately, a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a husband or wife, and you kiss each other, you close your eyes. Have you noticed this? You don't like your wife? You don't like your husband? Why do you want to close your eyes? Have you ever thought about it? Does it mean that the couple don't love each other? Why do we close our eyes? Because there is an subconscious admission, unconscious admission, that the pleasure that I am seeking in you is within me. I realize it. I want a certain happiness, a pleasure. That pleasure is truly within me. I am not able to get at it without your help. I am not able to reach it without your help. So I want you to help me reach out to this inner pleasure, inward bliss, inward happiness, inward delight. So as soon as you come close to me and I kiss you, I close my eyes and there it is inside. The delight is in me. It is felt in me. Your job is over. Now, can you examine this? Can you examine this? And see if one alone would do? Probably yes. In the case of a yogi or a great holy man who is able to meditate and enjoy this bliss of the Atman, of the Self, the external pleasure or the agent is not necessary. Nobody is necessary. He closes his eyes and he enjoys the supreme bliss. Okay. He is an exception, not the rule. In your case and mine, can we say that the inner pleasure or delight alone would do? The external agent is not necessary? Or, on the other hand, can you say that the pleasure was actually in that other person, your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your husband or wife or son? Do we admit that the pleasure was in the other person? No. It is when these two come together that there is this delight. Let these two go for 3 minutes. It is when the external agent turns our gaze within, enables us to look within, that we experience this inner delight. That it is the role of the external guru. The external guru, it may be a human personality, it may be an event in our life, it may be anything, it doesn't matter what it is. That external guru performs this vital and important task of directing our attention to this inner light. So that it is as foolish to say that the external guru was unnecessary as it is to say that he alone is important. Both are foolish. A wise seeker or wise student of yoga will recognize this as important and that also as important. There have been wonderful stories in our legends where devotion to the guru on the part of a student is exalted beyond all rational reasoning or logic, beyond all reason, beyond all rhyme or reason. This devotion to guru is exalted for its own sake. One story I'll tell you, it's very interesting. Where this great fact is brought out very clearly, that this external guru performs this vital task of turning your gaze within. That what is in front of you, though something has to be in front of you, what is in front of you is not of any consequence whatsoever. The hero of the scripture that we are studying is called Arjuna, a member of a princely clan who lived about 5,000 years ago. This Arjuna was learning archery from a great master. The master and the disciple were probably sitting in a forest, and the master was teaching the disciple how to shoot. The master was teaching the disciple how to shoot. The master was extraordinarily able, and the disciple was a prince, a warrior. A hunter who was also living in that forest came along, bowed to this master, and he said, "Sir, please teach me also. I also want to learn." And this great man asked him, "Who are you? What are your credentials? To which princely clan do you belong?" He said, "Sir, I am not a prince. I am an ordinary hunter. I am an ordinary hunter." He said, "Get out. No admission here except for princes." He said, "But please, sir, I am terribly devoted to you, I will worship you, etc., etc." He said, "No, nothing to do, get out." This man, this hunter, was deaf to whatever this man said. His mind was made up. "Here is my master, he is my master, nothing in the world is going to alter this conviction. That this is my master. I found my master." You have seen this probably in your own life. Somebody loves you or somebody doesn't love you, hates you. Whatever you say or do is of no consequence whatsoever. The other person has made up their mind, his or her mind. Quite likely you have had some experience like this. You try to convince the other person that you love her or don't love her. Doesn't seem to make any difference. Anyhow, as this thing went on, probably a couple of the master's disciples took him by the collar and threw him out. And he was still looking at the master. Oh, master, oh, master, what a wonderful man you are. Oh, master, oh, master. And he went home, thinking of the master. Oh, master, I want to learn archery from you. Probably he was sort of hysterical, a psychological case, half mad person. So he went home still dreaming and thinking of, sort of Romeo and Juliet business. He went home and as if possessed by a spirit, this love also is a spirit, as if possessed by a spirit, he went about making a small statue of the master with clay model. He had made a lovely little statue of the master. And to that master, he was still addressing his prayer. Master, please teach me how to shoot. I want to learn from you. I don't want to learn from anybody else. You are my master, nobody else. It's like a love-mad young man. I don't know if you have seen, I have seen a couple of them. Who, the girl doesn't want to look at him at all, and he takes a photograph and he keeps looking at her. You are still my darling. Never mind what you do, you are still mine. That sort of thing. I'm sure you have seen some people like this. Mad. But I suppose they are very good in their own way. It so happened, such is the power of devotion, it so happened that that statue began to teach him. How? I don't know. Doesn't some photograph talk to us sometime? Yeah? Doesn't some idol or some photograph talk to you sometimes? That is, if you are so keen and if your love is so intense. I was reading somebody's introduction to this I Ching book. You know the I Ching, don't you? There, this man says that this book, if you approach it with love or devotion, it will talk to you as if it was a living person. So, I think it is not beyond our comprehension to understand this. That if there is this devotion, mental openness, we are able to receive the message. So under the guidance of this statue, this young man began to practice archery. To him it was the living master himself. After some time, the real master and his disciple, royal disciple, they were practicing archery elsewhere, and there came a dog. The dog's mouth was open and so beautifully filled with arrows that it could not close its mouth. It wasn't killed. This was a special art, very secret art, which the master had taught only his beloved royal disciple Arjuna. He had taught nobody else. The master had told the disciple, I am teaching this specially to you, I am not giving this art to anybody else in this world. And here it is, the dog coming in front. The disciple looked at the master. Sir, you said, he didn't have to ask. Probably you bluffed me. You told me that you have not taught this trick to anybody else. And here is a dog. I didn't do this. That means you have taught it to somebody else. And the master said, who has done this? Arjuna, who has done this? I taught this only to you. He said, no, I didn't do anything. I don't know who has done this. The master also got up, intrigued. Let's find out. They followed the dog. And the dog led them to this hunter's house. hut. As soon as the hunter saw the great master come into his abode, oh, he ran forward, fell at his feet, "Sir, sir, sir, welcome, welcome, welcome." The master asked him, "Who did this? Who shot the arrows into the mouth of this dog in such a manner that the dog is not wounded but the mouth is sealed?" He said, "I did this, sir." "You did this? Who taught you?" "Sir, you, sir." "Me?" "I don't know who you are." Yes, sir, you taught me. I learned all this from you." And as the master walked in, he saw the statue of himself in the house and he knew. Not he. That's enough for us. This is the lesson that this little story teaches us. It is not the master in flesh and blood that is necessary. If it is there, good, well and good. Yes? So, when we say that a master in flesh and blood is not necessary, it does not mean that we should avoid all these masters in flesh and blood. No. If there is, take them. Accept them. Take their help. But that is not as important as me, as the devotion. Even a statue can teach me. Even a statue can divert or direct my attention to within me, to the light within me. If I have this tremendous devotion, this devotion is the discipline. This devotion, this love, this faith is the discipline I need in order to contact this inner spirit within me, inner light within me. I wonder if you realize the difference between the master-guru-disciple relationship and the teacher-pupil relationship. Yeah? You have these two. For a guru, there is a disciple. For a teacher, there is the pupil. You know, English is a funny language. You look at this word pupil, you know what it means? What does the word pupil mean? What does the word pupil mean? What does the word pupil mean? Pupil is one, is a student, isn't it? Pupil is a student in the class. One who sits in front of the teacher and listens. That's also a pupil. And also, these two things in the eyes, they are also called pupils. Why? Why is it so? Why is it that there are pupils in the classroom and there are pupils in the eyes? What is the relationship? Why is the same word used for two completely, totally different objects? Probably they are not different. There is some similarity. You know what a pupil does? The pupil of the eye? What is its function? Its function is to open wide when there is darkness, less light, and to close up when there is more light, isn't it? When you go in bright sunlight, the pupil of your eye closes up. You can see it vividly in the case of the cat. You can see it vividly in the case of the cat. Flash a light into the cat's eye, you can actually see it closing up. Switch it off, it will go open up. This you can see in the case of a cat. That's something very interesting. If you understand the true meaning, it is very interesting. The pupil is one who, when he approaches a great master, he closes up. The master is light. The great master is all light. Guru means light. And so when this pupil goes to the guru, he closes up. When he goes to the nightclub, he opens up. Nightclub is dark, isn't it? Now even this restaurant are all dark. So you don't know whether you are eating a snail or a sandwich. Well, one has to be very careful because, you know, the plastic spoons you can swallow, thinking they are parts of some vegetable. There's no light in the restaurants at all now. So there the eyes open wide. The eyes of this blind man, the eyes of the pupil. He whose eyes open wide in darkness and closes in front of the light of the guru is a pupil. He cannot gain anything. The relationship of the guru and the disciple is something interesting. Look at this word disciple again. Do you realize that there is a spelling mistake? Disciple. Is there another word which looks similar? Discipline.
Discipline.
Discipline. The word is actually discipline. There is no word called disciple. It's only an error in spelling. Somebody was typing and forgot two letters. So a disciple without discipline is meaningless. If I have this discipline and this devotion, devotion is the discipline. If I have discipline, I have devotion. If I have devotion, I have discipline. Both are synonymous. And discipline also means study, isn't it? Huh? The discipline of mathematics means study of mathematics, learning of mathematics. I must learn. Why do I go to a guru? In order to learn. In order to learn, I must be receptive. So these three things are necessary. I must have discipline, I must be receptive, and I must be devoted. If these three things are there, then whatever the guru is of no consequence to me, is immaterial to me. I can take a picture, meditate upon that picture. If I am receptive to the light, if I am disciplined, if I want to learn, and if I am devoted to my guru, I can learn. I can be benefited. He can teach me. Whether he is still in flesh and blood or in any form, in the form of a picture, anything. And therefore, this external agent, whatever it be, it may be a picture, it may be a statue, it may be a human being, it may be a book, it may be anything. I'm glad I did this I Ching introduction. And in the same way, I believe the early Christian fathers venerated the book, the Bible itself. The Holy Bible was venerated by them, and I read it. What's that book called? The Way of a Pilgrim, I think. Yes? The Way of a Pilgrim. Something concerning the early Christian fathers. One of these early Christian fathers tells his disciple, keep this Holy Bible with you. The devil will not come anywhere near you. And this young man says, sir, it is in Latin. I don't read Latin or Greek. Latin, I think. It is in Latin and I can't read Latin. He says, it doesn't matter if you can't read. It doesn't matter at all. You just keep the book because you may not be able to read. The devil knows. So the devil will keep away from you. It is that faith, it is that devotion that is necessary. If that devotion is there, then your mind is so receptive to the light that the trick is done. there is nothing that is needed in order to enable a mirror to reflect light. Nothing except that it be clean. That's all. So that the mind, my mind is able naturally to receive that light. I must merely ensure that it is clean. It is clean, receptive, therefore receptive, disciplined, and therefore receptive. And that it is turned in the proper manner. I need a clean mirror, and I need the mirror to be turned in a certain way, tuned in a certain way. This is all that is necessary between the guru and the disciple. I must have this discipline and the receptivity, and I must tune in to my guru. Then the trick is done. Therefore, if we adopt the right attitude to the guru, the advantage here is, even though the light is within me, I do not depend upon the me to lead to the light. If I depend upon myself, I may be getting caught or trapped in my own ego, in my own vanity, which has misled me all the time, which stands between me and self-realization, and I am once again, even in the spiritual quest, I am trying to depend upon my own ego, my own vanity. It does not help us. And therefore, Krishna himself says in the Bhagavad Gita, Tad viddhi pranipadena pariprasnena sevaya upadekshyantite jnanam jnaninas tattvadarshinah. Go to these great men, holy men, the men of enlightenment. Surrender yourself to them. Fall at their feet. Fall at their feet is not in the mechanical sense. Fall at their feet. Surrender to them. Ask them. Serve them. Then they will enlighten you. They will enlighten you not in the sense that they are going to show the light and you will attain self-realization. No, you will have to do it. Even after going to these great men, holy men, you will still have to take the necessary steps to attain self-realization. If the guru cannot eat for you and appease your hunger, the guru cannot attain enlightenment on your behalf. This vicarious enjoyment and vicarious whatever it is, you know. I think you got in Western society also, yes? That if my son is sick, I go to some priest or somebody, give him some money and ask him to conduct, have some prayer. Prayers said, yes? You heard him? Do you have prayers said on behalf of so-and-so? We have them in India also. If I want to pass an examination, I don't want to pray, I don't want to waste my time. So I go to a temple, drop some money there, and feel that God will come and write my examination. That's a bit difficult. If you had tried it, you might have failed. That's a bit difficult. I have to do it myself. So that when these two come together, inner aspiration and devotion, and this external agent, then when these two come together, there is the spark of light. That is the guru. Devotion to the guru, therefore, was the basis of all spiritual undertakings in India. Not only in India, in all truly spiritual society. And bowing down to our own master, Swami Shivananda, we shall commence the study of a little scripture called the Bhagavad Gita from tomorrow. As usual, we shall sit and meditate for a few minutes. This too, we shall gradually enlarge as we go along. Step by step. To begin with, please sit comfortably and with your back straight. Try this. It's another little trick. Please, don't shake your head. Keep looking straight in front, please. Keep looking straight in front. Don't turn your eyeball. Keep looking straight in front. Without turning your head and without moving your eyeball, can you see if your back is straight? And if it is not, can you correct it? Without moving your head, without looking, if you can do that, you have learned to look within yourself. Look within and at your own backbone. For the next couple of minutes, watch your own breathing. Listen to the breath, and as you listen, maybe you hear so hum. So inhaling and hum exhaling. Listen to your breath, listen to your breath. And as you listen to the breath, you are listening to so hum. If the mind begins to wander, bring it back to the breathing constantly.
त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् दुःखमुक्तिमान्तान् ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् दुःखमुक्तिमान्तान् ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् दुःखमुक्तिमान्तान् सर्वेषां स्वस्ति भवतु सर्वेषां शान्तिर्भवतु सर्वेषां पूर्णं भवतु मङ्गलं भवतु सर्वे भवन्तु सुखिनः सर्वे सन्तु निरामया सर्वे भद्राणि पश्यन्तु मा कश्चित् दुःखवाद् भवेत् असतो मा सद्गमय ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मा मृतं गमय ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्ति शान्ति